Damn, it works. Hi, family.
Hey.
I'm an alcoholic. My problem is Becky. I want to thank Layla for asking me to speak. My friend Michael A., he didn't volunteer me. He actually voluntold me that I was going to be here tonight. So I want to thank you for asking me to speak and get out of my comfort zone. I'd especially like to welcome our newcomers, Shelly and Rebecca. I'm so glad you ladies are here. Definitely the most important women people in this room tonight, and I hope I can give you some hope. I would like to congratulate Jules, Steve, Dawn, Tommy, Leah, Lynn, Jack, and Devin on all your milestones. That is amazing. And I'd like to welcome all of our visitors. God, I don't even know where to start. I don't know if you guys know this, but the Serenity Prayer that we say is like, it's one of the most beautiful prayers I've ever heard, but it's only part of the prayer. And I'd like to start off by reading the whole entire Serenity Prayer for you, if I may. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference, living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardships as a pathway to peace, taking, as he did, the sinful world as it is, not as I would have it, trusting that he will make all things right if I surrender to his will, so that I may be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with him forever in the next. Okay, I don't know why I'm just completely drawing a blank, probably because there's a lot of people in this room tonight. I knew what I was going to say. It's by the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I have been able to stay since January 31st of 2012, and for that, I'm eternally grateful. I want to thank everybody for coming here tonight. This is a great meeting. I am so nervous because I feel like there's just this big, I know there's no expectations. I know y'all are judging me, so it's fine. Go ahead, judge away. Makes me feel better. Thank you very much for that, Roger. I do want to just make a quick acknowledgement. A good friend of ours, Mike B., he just moved to Washington a few months ago, and he's actually speaking tonight as well, and he wanted me to say hello and tell you that he loves y'all, misses y'all very much, so I just want to say that real quick. I'm just really grateful that this meeting I've been to about 7 or 8 years ago, and I remember it being this big, but man, when you're on this side of the podium, it's like way bigger. And the speakers that I heard, they both came up from Los Angeles, and they were these like amazing circuit speakers. They were funny. I laughed. They told some real heart-jerking stories. I cried. And I thought, man, every time I came, I was so grateful to come because the message I heard was really strong recovery. And then when I was asked to speak, I just was like, oh my God. Okay, so I got, you know, some big shoes to fill, but not really. I mean, I'm so grateful to be an alcoholic because I have this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm so grateful to have this program. Like I said, my sobriety date is January 31st of 2012. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. I'm of service. I go to meetings regularly. And I pray, I meditate, I do everything that has been suggested of me because I don't want to go back out there, you know. One of the things I'm really grateful about being here tonight is because I get to give back what has been freely given to me. And one of the biggest things that's been given to me out of this program is hope. I remember when I first came into this room, I had none of that. I couldn't look anybody in the face. I knew people by shoes. I didn't know people by names. I didn't know people by faces because I couldn't look you in the face. I was so broken. I was so ashamed of what I was and what I had become. And so I literally recognized people by their shoes. And I remember coming, I'll go ahead and backtrack a little bit. That's just, you know, I just wanted to say, I want to give back what's been so freely given to me. So I actually grew up in the Paso Robles area. I'm from Paso Robles. I wasn't born there, but I might as well have been. I was raised in a family of dysfunction. You know, I think that's kind of a common thing nowadays. I grew up with a mom who was raising three kids by herself. She was really good. Her picker was broken, just like my picker has been broken my whole life. She liked to pick the ones that needed to be fixed, you know, and usually those entailed alcoholics or drug addicts in one shape or another. So I didn't really know any different growing up. I just thought that's the way it was. I remember when I was about 8 or 7 years old, we were driving, we were living in Heritage Ranch at the time. And the gentleman that she was with was definitely an alcoholic. And we were driving home from some event. I don't even remember because you're a little kid. You don't know. You just hop in the car. They say, come on, we're going. You go, okay. So you go. And we were coming back from somewhere. And all I know is, like, at one point we were driving. And the next thing I know, the car's spinning. And, you know, towards Heritage Ranch, there's a lot of, you know, cliffy areas. And we stopped off the side of the road. And I was just like, woo! Do that again. And had no clue that this gentleman, you know, was putting my life at risk. You know, I look back on that and I just thank God, that poor little girl, you know, that poor little girl. So really I've been around it my whole life. And my first drink, the only reason I know this is because over the last year I've been moving a lot. I've had a lot of change over the last year, and I came across one of my diaries when I was a little girl. And my first drink was on December 25th of 2013, and I was going from my grandmother's house. We were all at my grandmother's house for Christmas, and my stepbrother's wife needed to go home and get ready for the family gathering. So I went with her. She was in her parents lived in Atascadero, went to her house. Her parents were gone, so I was left all by myself in her parents' house while she was in the shower. And I'm in their house, and I'm looking around on their counter in the kitchen, and there, lo and behold, is this bottle of whiskey. I'm like, huh. Okay, well, you know, I didn't really know much about alcoholism. I knew my stepdad actually owned a liquor store, so I was around alcohol my whole life, but it just never really was something of interest to me. And I don't know why, but for some reason that day, that alcohol literally called my name. You know, Becky. Come here, Becky. I'm like, oh, okay, that thing's talking to me. So I decided I was going to try a drink. And like a good alcoholic, I took a really, really big drink because I don't do anything small. I go big or I go home. So I took a really big drink of this whiskey. I don't even know what kind it was. I just know it was really strong, and it really made me warm, and it made me pink, and it made me laugh. And instantaneously, I just felt like, wow, feels good. You know, growing up, I felt different. You know, I know it's so cliche, but it's true. You know, I felt different. I looked different. I didn't have a whole lot of friends. I tried to make friends wherever I go. I tried to be that chameleon. I played sports so I could be friends with the jocks. I played basketball, softball, volleyball, and I wrestled. I got straight A's so I could be accepted by the kids that got good grades. And no matter what I did, it just never worked. You know, nobody really ever accepted me. And, you know, as a kid, it was really important to feel like you were belonging somewhere. And no matter what I did, I could never really feel that sense of belonging. And for the first time in my life, the minute I took a drink of that, it was the first time in my life that I really didn't care anymore. Because I always cared so much, like so much. You know, I just wanted to have friends badly. But again, like a good alcoholic, one is never enough and 1,000 is too many. So I took another big swig of that. And my sister comes out, my stepsister, now sister, comes out, and she's looking at me. And I'm just standing there giggling, laughing, you know, 15, just, you know, she's just like, oh my God, what did you do? And I'm like, I don't know. And just kind of standing there, goofy grin, didn't know what to do, what's going on. But I knew I just didn't feel that sense of like awkwardness for the first time in my life. So I went back to my grandmother's house. My sister was all upset with me because she thought she was going to get in trouble because she takes me and I go and get shit-faced at her house and come back to my grandma's house. And I went to the bathroom. I threw up everywhere. And then I go back into the little guest room and I passed out in the bed and I blacked out. And that was my first time blackout drinker, you know. That's pretty much how my drinking career progressed. I was never just like, oh, I'm just going to have a little sip. Like, what? Who does that? Alcohol doesn't taste good, to me anyway. And so I never really drank just a little. I always drank a lot. I didn't like to feel the feelings of inadequacy. I liked the feeling that alcohol gave me, and it gave me that immediate effect of like, not so much that I fit in, but I just didn't care that I didn't fit in anymore. It changed the way I made me feel. I continued to do well in school. I still played sports. I ended up going to school up in Chico State. And they kind of know how to drink up there a lot. And so I went up there and I learned how to drink like the big boys, you know? It was a party. It was on nonstop. It was, you know, my freedom away from my home. It was the first time that I'd ever, you know, experienced independence. And God, I liked the way drinking made me feel. You know, I never drank just socially. It was always, I was on a mission. You know, if my teeth were not numb, I hadn't drank enough. You know, I remember that always being a really important thing to me. Like, oh, my teeth aren't numb. Okay, I got to keep drinking because I haven't quite arrived yet. But when I went to Chico State my freshman year, like I said, I drank every single time I drank, I blacked out. And I thought it was kind of funny because, like, I would never remember that night. And people would tell me the next night, like, all the shit I had done. And God dang, man, it was like kind of, you know, I'd have to like laugh it off because it was so embarrassing, the stuff that I was doing. It was pretty, you know, horrific. And I didn't see a problem with it because, you know, I was in college. That's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to go and get shit-faced and pass out, black out, and not remember the next day and have your friends tell you what you did. When I went up north, before I actually went up north, I also started doing other things. I smoked a lot of alcohol. And when I drank alcohol and smoked alcohol, whew, that was, yeah, another good time. One night I drank so much alcohol and smoked so much alcohol that when I went back to my dorms, my roommates couldn't wake me up. You know, and they tried to wake me up, and no matter what they did, they could not wake me up. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm trying to sleep, right? I'm passed out. I'm trying to sleep. That's what you do when you're drunk and you're passed out. You sleep. Don't wake you up. But for whatever reason, this particular night, they were concerned, you know? And so they called the RA. The RA did what the RA had to do. The RA called the 911, and paramedics showed up, and the fire department showed up, and the police department showed up, and they're trying to wake me up, and yeah, I was passed out. You know, I'm in my own room in the dorms, you know, and so I don't know who it was. Somebody, one of these agencies, got that smelling rock stuff and woke me up, and I'm there, and I'm like, "Ooh, hello, got strippers in my room." Sweet. This is all right. No, we're having a party, all right. And these guys even have props. You know, there's a stretcher and everything. Wow. It's pretty, they must think, you know, I don't know, it's kind of cool. Didn't quite understand what was going on, obviously. And I told the cops and the officers and everything, I'm just sleeping. I'm fine. Just, I'm good. Just leave me alone. I'm just going to stay here and go back to sleep. I was sleeping. You kind of, you know, how rude. And they're like, no, you need to come downtown with us. I said, no, I'm good right here. Like, I'm going to stay right here. Can you guys just please go? You're bothering me. The officers didn't really like that. They didn't give me a choice. They said, well, actually they did. They gave me a choice. They said, we can either take you downtown right now because you have been, drinking and you're under the age of 21, or you can get on the stretcher and go get checked out by, you know, the hospital staff, make sure you're okay. So, I made the right choice, got on the gurney and went to the hospital and got checked out, and they put an IV in my arm, and, you know, I sat there like just pissed. You know, because I'm like trying to sleep and, you know, they're not letting me sleep. And, you know, so that was 19. That was my first hospital stay. And I didn't see anything wrong with that. You know, I just thought that's what you do. You know, you go to college, you go to parties, you black out, you go to hospitals. You know, so what, doesn't everybody do that? That's normal, right? Sure. So I ended up leaving Chico State, went to Fresno State for about 6 months. I had met my daughter's dad in that whole process. And when I was 20 years old, I got pregnant. And I had my daughter when I was 21. I was able to stop drinking at that time. Partying was a big part of my story. But I was able to at least, when I had a child, put that aside. And, but it was hard, you know, it was not easy. It was not like I was like easily just put down the drink. I was all kind of resentful. That's this, you know, I'm getting fat and I can't drink and, rude. But I did it because that's the right thing to do. And, I ended up having my daughter when I was 21. So I didn't get to go to the whole bar thing, you know, and that was a big, big deal for me, you know, turning 21 and being able to go to the bars and like buy my own alcohol and like do that was like really important to me. And I couldn't do it because of this kid. And it's like, you know, it's like I say it jokingly, but it was truly like an inconvenience. You know, having children was like it kind of messed up my drinking. Ended up breaking up off with things with her, her father when she was about 3 weeks old, because we couldn't get along. And once I was finally done nursing, it was time to start drinking again, you know. And while she was about 1 year old, I went to back to school. I went back to Cal Poly and I got my paralegal certificate because I knew that I had this child now I had to serve, you know, provide for. I needed to do something. And so I went to the paralegal program through Cal Poly, got my paralegal certificate. And I worked really hard, you know. I was not drinking at the time, so I was able to focus on schooling, went to school full time, was working 2 part-time jobs and raising a 1-year-old child with the help of my parents. You know, I've always had help with my parents because being a single mom is definitely not an easy job. To all the single mamas out there doing it on their own, man, power to you. You know, you're like the most badass people that I know. Just going to say that right now. So once I was able to start drinking again, I did, you know, and working in the legal industry, there's a lot of stuff that goes on in the legal industry, you know, besides the drinking. You know, you start not just smoking your alcohol, but you start snorting your alcohol and you start doing other things with your alcohol. And, you know, I respect Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why I try not to talk about outside issues, but you guys get the point, right? Like my life ended up taking me to where kids was not a priority, you know. My partying was a priority, not feeling was a priority in my life, and I definitely didn't like feeling. You know, I didn't like having to be responsible, and then I felt entitled to party the way I did because I had a career, you know. I was a mom. And I didn't do this stuff while my kids were awake. You know, I was a good mom, and I waited till they were asleep. And I would sit there and stand there and just with my arms across my chest waiting for them to make them go to sleep so I could go out and do my thing, because that's how selfish this alcoholic is, you know. And they'd fight that, man. I'd be like, no, you need to go to bed. And it was, you know, just it was, again, my kids were an inconvenience. You know, I love my kids more than anything in this world. I say kids plural because I did end up having another. So I got my first UI in 2004 when I was working for Mr. Funky Baloo. good old Elon Funky Baloo, bless his heart, got me off on a wet reckless. So it was great. You know, I worked for the right guy to get a DUI. I was like, wait, I can't get a DUI. I work for Funky Baloo. And they're like, oh, yes, you can. And you're gonna. Getting locked up with our clients was pretty humiliating, you know. But that's what I did. And 2005, a year later, I ended up getting my second DUI. And I got ordered to the second DUI program. I had to do all the fines. I had to do jail time. And when I went to the second DUI program, I met the second love of my life. He was pretty cute. And I'm like, oh, hey, how you doing? Want to go get a drink after this? So it was perfect, right? You go to DUI class and you meet your baby daddy. Awesome. And you would think the night that we're sleeping together and he pees all over me, that might have been a clue that, oh, maybe this isn't the best guy for you. But I thought, oh, my God, he loves me. Gave me a golden shower. Oh, isn't that cute? So we made a baby. And, you know, what's wrong with that, right? I mean, we're just having fun. You know, I just, that kind of came to me the other day, and I was like, God, I got to talk about that, because that's the insanity. That's the insanity. I mean, come on, is that insane or what? Young love. So, yeah, had the second child, and, you know, life just kind of spiraled out of control. I was doing this thing, again, left him when my son was 3 weeks old because he couldn't quit drinking. You know, he was on dialysis for 3 months, life support for 8 days at the age of 32, but he didn't have a problem. You know, and I was like, wow, kind of woke me up for a little while. I actually got sober for about 3 years after that one, you know, because I saw what alcoholism did. And I still didn't have a problem, though. He had a problem. I went to another program because I was a codependent. You know, I was part of Celebrate Recovery, which is a 12-step program through the churches, because of my codependency, you know, not because of my drinking problem, pot problem, cocaine problem. It was because of him. And like I've heard so many times, when you point that finger at somebody, you got three pointing right back at you. You know, but I didn't see it. And one up at God, too. I don't know if you guys have ever noticed that one. When you do that, you do. But anyway, so I went to a program. I went to Al-Anon. I went to Celebrate Recovery. And I never looked at myself because I didn't want to look at myself. You know, I didn't want to ever admit that I had a problem, because once you admit you have a problem, you kind of have to do something about it. And I wasn't done yet. You know, I just wasn't done yet. I was still having a good time. Even though I had two DUIs, I ended up getting another, a drunk in public. I just wasn't done yet. And it took a lot for me to finally get to be done. I ended up doing a lot of things that I never thought I would do. You know, all the men, yeah, whatever. That just comes with the territory. All the like waking up, like, where am I? Who are you? What did I do last night? The incomprehensible demoralization. You know, I lived that for many, many years. But yeah, I just didn't want to look at myself because I wasn't done yet. I don't know if you guys get this, but, you know, alcoholics, you know, some of us are survivors. Not all of us are, though. Alcoholism is just like cancer. You know, the disease of alcoholism wants to kill its host, and often does, you know, just like cancer does. And, you know, I ended up being so sick, and sometimes it's hard to remember the past. I don't ever want to shut the door, forget the past, because if I do, then I might just go right back to it. But my past took me to some really dark places. And, you know, I got to the point where I just, the reality, the psychosis of all of it, you know, I didn't know what was real. I thought my kids had been taken and put lookalike kids in there. and taught to say things to mess with me. You know, I thought the billboards were specifically for me to just mess with me. I thought our phones were tapped. I thought our computers were tapped. I'm working in law offices at this whole time, and I was underneath my desk hiding at work going, shh, don't talk, they're listening. And my boss, who so kindly had introduced me to crack cocaine, tells me, it's okay, you're not the first and you're not the last. And I'm like, fuck, they are listening and they are watching me. And so we went to do our thing, and come to find out years later, he wasn't talking about that. He meant he was, I'm not the first person to lose my mind from drinking and drugging, and I'm not going to be the last. Well, that motherfucker didn't say that. I thought he confirmed, yeah, you are being watched. Dude, I just drank, and I just used. I was not big. I was not a big fish. I was such a little tiny, you know, I was just a sick person. But he sent me so far over the edge that I called my daughter's dad and said, hey, look, you got to come get our daughter because they're watching me. They're going to come get me. And I'm smoking crack. I'm doing this. I'm doing that. And he's just like, oh, my God. So he does the right thing, and he comes and ex-parties to court, and he gets an emergency order and takes my daughter away from me. I remember the day that they came and took her, because we went to court over this. You know, it was not like a big surprise. This is like, I'm kind of present, but not really physically. That's about it. They come, and her dad comes in, and she's in the middle of the fifth grade. She's 10 years old in the middle of the day, and her dad comes all the way over from the valley and pulls her out of school. And I told my boss, who introduced me to crack, you know, that I had to go say goodbye to my kids. So I'm like driving over the grade. I'm like, oh, la, 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 you know, and I get there. I'm like, bye, Taylor, bye, you know, just like fucking clueless. You know, like kissing my kid goodbye. Not a clue. Like just thinking, okay, she's just going to go and I don't know what I'm going to do. And I'm just going to like, you know, go say goodbye to my kid. That poor little girl. God, that poor little girl. She lived with her mom, her brother, her grandma, and her grandpa. And one day daddy comes and takes her away. And that was it. She was gone. Just like that. And I'm just like, bye. Bye. You know, and it was pretty low. That was that was the hardest thing I've ever walked through in my life. I cried for months. I'm trying to think if I got sober right then and there. No way. No way did I get sober. The pain was too unbearable. I couldn't feel that pain. So I just kept doing what I do. My son's dad, because I met him in the DUI program, he was too sick to try to come take my son away from me, but I did voluntarily give up custody because I didn't want that chance to happen. I didn't want to give him the opportunity. And, you know, that did wake me up enough to make me realize that I did need to go get some help. So I did go. I didn't know what kind of help I needed. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to go. My parents were at a loss. They didn't know what to do with me. They called mental health. They thought, well, maybe mental health can come help her. And I'm freaking gone at that point. And mental health crisis unit said, well, we can't help her unless she's at risk or she's going to harm herself or harm somebody else. And I go, oh, I can do that. Sure, no problem. So I go in my parents' house. I grab a knife. I come back out. And I just took this knife and I went like that with a dull end. Cause I don't want to live, but I'm too chicken shit to die. You know, but I got help. You know, that crisis unit, sent the police. Police came, took me away. I was raging. I was just raging. I didn't know. I'd lost my daughter. I didn't lose my daughter. I don't ever say I lost my kids. You don't lose your kids. You lose your car keys. I gave my kid away. You know, I chose to drink over my children. And so I'm getting help. I'm being sent to mental health. I went to the mental hospital. And I was there for like, seemed like forever. thinking I'm on scared straight because, again, the psychosis, right? I'm thinking my kids were, you know, not my kids, and I'm thinking the billboards were all fake and this is all fake news. And I'm in there, and, you know, I just got to get out of there. I was hurting. I was physically withdrawing. I thought that, oh God, the things I thought, you know, I'm going to share some of it because some of y'all can relate, you know, the crazy, right? So I thought, because when I got taken in there, they took some of my stuff. I thought that they had taken my stuff and put it inside of me, and I was going to give birth to my stuff. I thought that every time I heard a helicopter, they were coming to get me and take me away. I'm like, oh good, you know, I thought the cigarettes I was smoking had something in them, because every time I smoked one, I felt so freaking lightheaded. It was so weird. And I was like, I guess maybe I am in the right place, but no, these people are crazy, right? So it was like 6 days later, and they wanted to keep me an extra 2 weeks, and I'm like, no, I got to get out of here because these people are fucking crazy. And I'm in there, and they have a telephone to call people. It's a payphone. They actually have a payphone in mental health. The wire's like, you know, that long or whatever. And I'm like in there trying to hang myself, you know, because like, I am not crazy, but these people are crazy. Okay, that makes no sense. But one of the best things that happened to me was when I was in that mental hospital, and that's when H and I came in, and I heard I first heard the message of hope. You know, I don't remember what was said. It was like wah 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 wah, and I was like, huh, okay. But I heard something that made me think, well, There's got to be another way, you know, there's got to be another way to live. And I wasn't sure what that looked like or what that was about, but I knew that the way that I was living was not a good way of living. My way of living got me into the mental hospital. You know, my way of living got my children removed from my care. So I ended up going to residential in Santa Barbara at the Bethel House. I almost said the Methel House, but you know, same thing. Bethel. Still have a little bit of problems here, but that's okay. You know, I at that point wanted help. I don't know if I had quite admitted that I was an alcoholic, but I knew that I needed to do something different because the lifestyle I was living and where my drinking and drugging had brought me, I didn't want that. You know, I didn't mean to mess up my life like that. That was not like what I intended to do. I didn't mean to break apart my family and take that little girl's family away from her. I didn't mean to do all that. I've never been a bad person. I've just been a sick person. You know, I don't think any of us are bad people. You know, we're just sick. So when I'm in there, I got this court order that gave me a 6-month zero contact with my daughter. You know, she's in Fresno. I can't write her. I can't call her. I can't do anything. But that didn't stop me from writing her anyway, you know. And I remember when I first finally got to talk to her on the phone, I'd be like, hey, babe, hey, how's it going? How are you? Oh, I didn't know how to talk to my kid. You know, I just, how are you? How are you? Like, really? How is she? How do you think she is? Well, on March 24th, 2011, I got this letter from my daughter. Dear Mom, I hope things are all good. I hope you can understand where I'm coming from when I say I'm not comfortable when I have to see you. I feel mad and sad for both myself and Aiden for what you put us through. I feel like I can't talk to you because you will not understand. Maybe you can find a way to show that I can trust you again. Love always, Taylor. P.S. How do you think I feel? Okay. From the mouths of babes. You know, thank God for these kids. Thank God for their honesty. I wish I could say that when I finally got sober, because my first attempt was in January of 2011, I wish I could say that was it for me, and I've been here ever since. But I wasn't here to get sober for me. I was here to get my kid back. You know, when I first started, that stay in Bethel House only lasted a month. That was very unfortunate because I really wanted to get better, but I was emotionally unstable. I missed my daughter. I was in this house with these women that were off the streets, that were out of jail, you know, and I'm like a professional, you know, and I'm like this, like, I mean, I don't know, look at me, right? But that's me looking at like the differences. I didn't see the similarities. And so I got kicked out of there. And talk about getting kicked when you're down. You know, I wanted help. I really wanted help. So I came back when I was there, I heard about 8600. I ran to 8600. I got involved. I heard about AA. I heard about NA. I heard about mental health transitions. I went through Pogue. I got into drug and alcohol services. I went to parenting classes. I did a lot of stuff. You know, I wasn't working at the time because my head was still like way out there, and I had all the time in the world. You know, I got busy. I got a sponsor. I started working some steps. But again, I wasn't here to get well. I wasn't here for me. I was here to get my daughter back. So about 6 months into my journey, I did have a bump and I relapsed. And when I relapsed, my mom had started going to Nar-Anon. And the sister program to one of our other programs, sister programs. And she learned not to enable me. And she learned what it looks like when people are doing things they shouldn't be doing. And so she kind of caught on that I might have been doing things I shouldn't be doing. She set me up. She knew where I was going to do the things I shouldn't be doing. And she watched me do the things I wasn't supposed to be doing. And she busted my butt. And she kicked me out. And she saved my life that night. You know, because if she hadn't done that, I would have continued to go down this road and I would have just kept doing the things I was doing. But because she kicked me out, I had no one else to do it for at this point. You know, I wasn't with my kids anymore. It was all about me. So I thank my mom for that. That was the hardest thing she ever had to do. Talk about tough love, you know. But she saved my life that night. And so I got back here, you know, by the grace of God, I did make it back into this room. And you know, I got busy again, and this time I started doing it for me. You know, I wanted nothing more than my daughter to come back home. I wanted nothing more to get my family back intact. God, that was important to me, but I had to let that go. You know, I had to do this for me. And I learned that no matter what, if my daughter was with me or not with me, I was always going to be there for her. And, you know, what a gift to... You know, relapse, you know, it's not a part of recovery. It's part of the disease. I don't wish relapse on anybody, but if it's going to teach you something valuable that's going to save your life, then bring it on. You know, I would never wish losing your children on any mother, but if it's going to help get you, like, pull your head out so you can hear that, then do it, you know? There's so much, you know, there's just so much that, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I walked through some stuff in this program. In 2016, I lost my pops. You know, that was the hardest thing I walked through by far. The hardest thing I walked through. I don't know how I got through that, but except for by the steps, by the rooms, by the fellowship, by the grace of God, you know, by my desire to want, no matter what, to not want to go back to that lifestyle. I got to walk my dad through to the other side. You know, what a gift. You know, I would not want to go through that again, but I'm so grateful that I got to be present. I got to witness some things that if I had been drinking, you know, I would have missed it all. You know, I would have missed it all. And yeah, it hurt. It hurt bad. But I got to walk through that, you know, with you all. You know, I didn't have to do it alone. You know, I'm so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous because it's given me this amazing family, this amazing fellowship that I don't have to do anything alone. They say don't get in a relationship when you're, you know, first, you know, year of recovery. Well, you know, I'm an alcoholic. I like to break the rules. So when I was a year in my first recovery, I met my next love of my life. I had a lot of those, apparently. Anyway, we were together for 9 years, and last Thanksgiving, he decided to split it off with me. You know, I've been coming around long enough to know that this is the stuff that takes people out. You know, death, relationships, losing people, losing relationships. So what did I do? I got busy, man. I don't want to go back. I love the gifts that I've been giving. I love to feel today. I love to love today. I have this like amazing ability to love people like I've never loved before. You know, it's like, it's like almost like this weird thing, but like, it's always been there, but now I've nurtured it, you know, through the steps and through all this stuff. And, you know, I got into 3 meetings every day with this breakup. I picked up 3 new sponsees. I picked up a commitment service at the convention committee. I didn't want to go back to that lifestyle. And so, I've been able to get through. I've been, you know, blessed by, you know, countless friendships in this program. You know, I get to wake up every day. I wake up feeling good. I know where my car is parked. I know who this guy is. Well, now there is no guy, but whatever. I know who's not here. and I'm okay with that. You know, I'm okay with that. You know, alcoholism is really no funny matter, but I try to make light of it because it's like, it truly is life or death. You know, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. I try to be happy, joyous, and free, and I pretty much am on a pretty regular basis, but there's like a sincere reality about this disease. You're either in here working this disease as if your life depended on it, because it absolutely does, or you're not. You're either working on your recovery or you're working on your relapse. There's just no in between, you know, and lately I've been seeing a lot of people go out. You know, I've had a lot of people, the longer I've been here, the more people I lose that I love so much. And it's just not something that I wish on anybody. But if I wasn't an alcoholic, I wouldn't have all of you, you know? And so it's like, well, I mean, there's some really, really amazing things. Because I'm an alcoholic, I get to have this program that has saved my life, you know? It's given me a life and it's saved my life. So I'd like to read a little couple things and then I'm going to get on out of here because I know we all got lives and people and things to go do. So people to do? Oh, well, I didn't mean to say that. Maybe I need to go get people to do. Just kidding. Just kidding. Okay. So this is on page 317. When I'm willing to do the right thing, I am rewarded with an inner peace no amount of liquor could ever provide. When I'm unwilling to do the right thing, I become restless, irritable, and discontent. It is always my choice. Through the 12 steps, I have been granted the gift of choice. I am no longer at the mercy of a disease that tells me the only answer is to drink. If willingness is the key to unlock the gates of hell, it is action that opens those doors so that we may walk freely among the living. This is on 318. Life has not heaped monetary riches upon my head, nor have I achieved fame in the eyes of the world. My blessings cannot be measured in those terms. No amount of money or fame could equal what was given to me. Today, I can walk down any street, anywhere, without the fear of meeting someone I've harmed. Today, my thoughts are not consumed with the craving for the next drink or regret for the damage I did on the last drunk. Today, I reside among the living, no better, no worse than any of God's other children. Today I look in the mirror when putting on my makeup and smile rather than shy away from looking myself in the eye. Today I fit in my skin. I am at peace with myself and the world around me. If nobody has told you today that they love you, I love you. Mm-hmm. I'm really grateful for all of you for being a part of my recovery, so thanks for letting me share.